no, I'm good. Let's do it. Let's do it. Pretty informal. I mean, we just sort of just launch in and we get, geeky about a story. And this one has been on my mind to do forever. And I thought how much fun it would be to talk about it with you. And I just was wondering, maybe you could just start by telling us like your memories of first encountering this story and what that was like.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. We're thrilled that joining us for this episode is the inimitable ZZ Packer to discuss the sublime story by James Allen McPherson, Gold Coast. ZZ Packer and Peter Orner were both students of James Allen McPherson during their time at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. ZZ Packer has written about the profound influence that James Allen McPherson has had on her. She considers him one of the smartest and wisest people she's ever known and has said that he, quote, cared so much and so deeply and that he was just so intent on finding what was emotionally the best and the most human and humane way to exist in the world. And we see irrefutable evidence of this humanity in the story Gold Coast by James Allen McPherson. The protagonist, Robert, is an assistant janitor. And while he draws a line before the idea of becoming any more full-fledged in that role, he still gives compassion and consideration over to James Sullivan, a man who is a janitor, has always been one, it seems, and ever will be. But for James Allen McPherson, is never, could never be, just that. Robert spends time listening to Sullivan, trying to see him as more than just whatever the tenants in the rest of the building see, someone in a lowly job, someone not deserving of their respect, someone whose very obvious issues with alcohol, with his marriage, even with his pet dog, are considered only repugnant and are never taken into account with any amount of empathy. ZZ Packer considers this working relationship with Robert and Sullivan as the heart of the story. Robert is someone who's managing issues of race and class. He has aspirations and goals. He is Black and knows that this fact could set him apart from the complaining tenants and from the world that exists beyond the building, including at Harvard. Instead, the tenants complain to Robert about Sullivan. Spending so much time with Sullivan certainly can't be helping matters, but Robert continues to listen to Sullivan, to spend time with him, even though these are never easy visits. The one mainstay in these tensions and exchanges, as ZZ Packer points out, is Robert's humanity. Peter Orner has also written about James McPherson. Above all, writes Peter Orner, he was interested in what makes people human. He said that McPherson was someone who encouraged his students and protégés not to follow anybody's script, not even their own. Another thing Orner admired about him is that he loved to collect examples of human beings refusing to be typecast. And that's another important part about Gold Coast, as we'll see. It would be easy to see each character, Robert, Sullivan, Jean, Meg, and Miss O'Hara, and the other tenants in the small world Robert inhabits in some stereotypical way. That was not what James Allen McPherson saw in people. In fact, Peter Orner now considers moments when someone offers a generous instinct that overcomes an imposed identity as a McPherson moment. When you encounter those McPherson moments in Gold Coast, you're just kind of happy to have encountered a story like this one. And to have ZZ Packer join us to guide us along? What could be better? Here now, ZZ Packer, Peter Orner, and I discuss Gold Coast by James Allen McPherson.
When I knew I was going to Iowa, the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and that Jim was there, I had read some of his stuff, but I think this was just very informally because I knew of Francine Prose, and she had, I remember her talking about Gold Coast. It's one of those things where you kind of think, oh, I think I've read that story. And then I just remember when I know that it was sometime when I was at Iowa And I was just reading everything of Jim's. I was trying to read all these things, like Zola and just so many other people as well. But then I read Gold Coast and remembered, like, wait a second. I have not read this story, because if I had read this story, it would have stuck with me for forever. I would have known, you know. So this is just kind of one of those stories that I'll just go back to, you know, because I just love how he is able to start talking to you in a way, like start telling you this story about, you know, when he, Robert, you know, not Jim, became a janitor. But it has this very much this sort of, it seems very autobiographical. And so your guard is kind of let down and you don't really understand until you're reading it how utterly crafted it is. I don't know what else to say about the story. I mean, I have many things to say about the story, but about the remembering the story, except for that recognition that this was just brilliant and I hadn't indeed read it the way I thought I had read it.
But I think you nail it, though. The idea of, like, you know, just reading the story this morning, you know, and I probably read it, I don't know, 25 times. There is this sense of, like, you're in mid-conversation with an old friend. And maybe it's been a few years, but all of a sudden that voice again. And you're right. We knew the writer, so it means something maybe different in a way. But to me, it is, I'm talking to Rob again. And here he goes, and he's going to tell me about Sullivan and his wife. And yeah, it's just like, I can't read it enough times.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that Jim McPherson is able to do in this story is to show you, sometimes people, when they're writing stories, especially young people, are very cautious about, you know, is this going to be racist? Is this going to offend women? Is this going to offend a whole segment of the population? And I understand that, and I actually have that feeling, you know, because a lot of, you know, writers in decades past didn't have that feeling. But the thing that Jim is able to do in this story about this young man, Rob, is to show that you can have this character, Sullivan, who is the janitor that he's learning from, or says that he's learning from, who's really his friend. And who's really this, you know, lonely, even though he's surrounded by all these people, you know, in this building, is to show you that this person can have certain views and be certain, you know, and just be kind of a little bit trapped in the amber of his own circumstances. And that doesn't make him a bad person, you know, and then you have a kind of way in which you can kind of laugh along with Rob and with Sullivan. On the one hand, the limit of his world, but on the other hand, because it's the limit of his world, you know that this is not necessarily his fault. And so you're getting to see, like, many, many, many layers, you know, in the way that a lot of stories, I think, sometimes these days don't do. I just think that's an incredible, impressive feat that Jim, that he's able to do in the story.
And it's all over his work, and it was all over his teaching, and, you know, and not to be afraid. And,
absolutely.
And, you know, if your characters are going to be complicated, they're going to be complicated. And to me, reading this time, and it's so, you know, it's so great to talk to you about it. I mean, we haven't talked, like, in this way in a long time. You know what I mean?
And,
like,
I know.
But I want to say one thing and quote, middle of the story, the old woman, Miss O'Hara, and he have she's kind of like, you know, what they might call, and I don't know if this is offensive or not, forgive me, everybody, but, you know, lace curtain Irish, right? She is, you know, she looks down on, you know, the dirty janitor Sullivan. And Sullivan, about her, says this. She says, "Don't trust her, Robert. It was her kind that sat around singing hymns and watching them burn saints in this state, in Massachusetts." And it was just such a great, like, just, I mean, incredible takedown. You know, like,
yes,
this is the lady who's watching the witches burn and not saying anything, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then she has her own kinds of ways. It's almost like they're trying to have custody over him in a way, you know, the way that, like, you know, you have sometimes bickering parents who don't understand that they're causing their kid harm or something, where she's trying to woo him, Robert, to his side and says, "He's really a filthy old man, Robert." And then she said in closing, "And don't be afraid to report him to the property manager anytime you want." You know, and it's just, you know, one of these things where you could see this sort of back and forth, and she continually says, "He's just a filthy old man." she would declare in an old, little old lady whisper, "And don't think you have to clean up those dirty old butts of his. Just report him to the company." And he kind of is always trying to beg her off, saying that he doesn't mind. And she's telling him that there are a couple of lushes, meaning Sullivan and his wife, Meg. But the thing is that I think this is so great that one of the things that Jim is doing is his sort of feed-in method and how he's able to kind of give you information. So even though you have seen Sullivan drink, you know, it's only her, she who will say she's the one who declares who they are, you know.
A lot of people listening might not have read the story. So the context here is important, but we'll get to it. But I want to say one totally geeky thing, and that is that you kind of referred to this, is his use of indirection, you know, I guess technically indirect dialogue. So he says to her, but he doesn't say to her, it's told to us in a paragraph, "I assured her that I would do it at the slightest provocation from Sullivan." You know, in other words, report him to the property manager. And he does this a lot where he describes telling the character something as opposed to putting into dialogue. And it's something, you know, kind of Salinger would do really beautifully, but McPherson does it with such sort of comedy. You know, it's some of the funniest parts of the story are when he is telling us how he told them that, yeah, I'm listening to you, but I'm really not listening to you, because we know it's total bullshit. He's not going to report anybody to the property manager.
Absolutely.
You know, he doesn't need to be a janitor, and yet he's a janitor. He's a young black guy. How old do you think he is in this story? 25, 26?
Yeah.
The autobiographical element is, you know, we know that Jim went to Harvard Law School, and we know that this was a place that he knew pretty well. I have no idea how autobiographical the story is or not, but he clearly knows the streets, and he knows the buildings of Harvard Square. And that is some of the most delightful parts of this. It's just this sort of inside how an entire universe is contained in this building.
Yeah, but I think the other thing that I love about it is how deceptively simple he starts it off. Peter, you gave a great encapsulation of the story. Is that he's a janitor. He doesn't have to be a janitor. But he also starts off by saying that he imagined that later on in his life there would be capsule biographies, he said, of my life, this is a quote, on dust jackets and of many books, all proclaiming, and then in quotation marks, he knew life on many levels, freelance waiter, third cook, janitor. He rose to ...
Right.
And the idea of potential, you know, and having gone from one low place, or supposedly low place, to this high place. And he doesn't state what the high place is, although we can imagine if this capsule biographies, and he concentrates later on, you see these little inlets of him talking about stories and gathering stories from the trash and whatever. So you just assume that it is a writer that he's talking about, that we would have these capsule biographies for. And so the idea of being a janitor, you know, he says also, "I think it might have been because it is possible to be a janitor without becoming one." And then the idea is that he imagines himself in a way doing what I think, you know, young white people of that era might have done, which is to use the word slumming, where he could, you know, do something that he didn't have to do, you know, but this would provide this sort of founts of experience from which you could draw and have these stories.
And I would say guilty as charged. I am literally looking right now at my City of Iowa City taxi driver identification card that I proudly display on my desk, because I was a cab driver in Iowa City. I stayed an extra year, and I drove.
I stayed a little bit later. Yeah. And I worked at George's, which is as a barback. You know, and so I think we all have these ideas where it's sort of like, I mean, it's not as though you're not getting paid. You're getting paid.
Oh, and also, you know, you're doing the job, right? I mean,
exactly, you're doing
a lot of shit happened to me in that cab. And I'm sure George is my God, right?
Yeah. But that idea of potential, where as long as you can keep in your head this idea that I am doing this job, but this job is not the whole of me, then you are always kind of able to kind of almost like a go fishing with it, like a fish hook that goes, you know, you have a fishing line that you cast out and, you know, you draw something back, you know, from it, hopefully fish, I guess. But like, I feel as though with these jobs, you take them because that you see yourself as doing something so that you can be something else later, you know, like the, you know, proverbial, you know, waitressing and waiting, you know, actors in Hollywood. And I think that this is just, you know, him residing in potential, you know, as this, you know, this character, Robert.
And, but like you say, he's doing the job. He describes mopping the floor and Mrs. O'Hara's bugging him. And he's like, it's painful. It's a lot. He's doing a lot of mopping. And now he's got this boss, this nominal boss that wakes him up at 2 a.m. and wants to talk to him about, you know, the American Medical Association, the NAACP, all these things. Like, he's like, you know, this is not an easy thing, but he's immersed in it in a way that I guess what attracts me most about this character has always been the level of openness that Rob has towards Sullivan, even though everybody's telling him, what are you wasting your time on this old man for? This old drunk who's married to another old drunk who's certifiably crazy, basically, you know, and yet Rob hangs in there. And yes, but transparently, you know, there's even a line where he says he could be a story if I listened long enough. And then the girlfriend, Jean, says there are too many stories about old people.
I remember that. That's...
And then he says back, he says, no, I said, thinking about us again, the couple. There are just too many people who have no stories.
Yeah.
It's sort of that devastating sort of subtext of his own relationship. But anyway, Yvette, yes.
Oh, I was going to go back to this idea that he does the job. He very much does the job and smells the smells and does all of the things and gets caught up in sort of the, you know, the politics of the building with Sullivan and with O'Hara and with everybody else. In that second section, there is this bit about the neighbors where he says, in those days, I believed myself gifted with a boundless perception and attacked my daily garbage route with a gusto superenforced by the happy knowledge that behind each of the 50 or so doors in our building lived a story, which could, if I chose to grace it with the magic of my pen, become immortal. So when I read that, and it's, you know, it's sort of early on in the story, I still don't know him well enough, but I really kind of trust that this is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And the rest of that paragraph is so beautiful too, with this idea about his search for material and these discoveries. And then that list on the next page of, you know, the things that he discovers. The lady in number 24 was an alumna of Paducah College and so on and so forth. So I just love those details because it shows that he has a job and he's doing it, but he also knows himself as a writer and is pursuing that in his way. And then, you know, we have to read the rest of the story to sort of see, you know, the rest of this journey for him.
Absolutely. I love that a bit with you talking about how he wants to see every person, every door, you know, as a story. And even just giving us the little bits that he gives us, you know, you already mentioned the lady in number 24 was an alumnus of Paducah College. And then number two, the couple of 55, number 55 made love at least 500 times a week. And the wife had not discovered the pill. Number three, the lady in number 36 was still having monthly inconvenience and goes on to the fat man in number 54 had two dogs that were married to each other, but he was not married to anyone at all. And then we have that last one, the middle-aged single man in number 63 threw out an awful lot of flowers. And so one of the things I think he's also doing is kind of showing us you could have a story that's just all these little bits, but what actually makes the story cohere? And it is his friendship with Sullivan, you know? And so the real story is kind of, you can get these details that are like on the fringes, you know, about these other people. But then really what a story is and at the heart of it is this humanity. You know, who is this man? Why is he connected to him in this way? I mean, is it just the job? And I think that in the end, we understand that it can't be, he does the job, yes, but it's not just this job. It is like the humanity at the core of Sullivan that he's attracted to, and he's trying to figure it out a little bit like a puzzle, you know? And the only way to do that is to live with the person, you know? And right. I feel, when I say live with, not literally live with, but to be this sort of companion.
I was just going to say, Sullivan is the janitor. You know, Sullivan is the janitor.
Yeah, I mean, Sullivan is the real janitor, but he's also the like, he says later on, Sullivan talks later on and says, I could have done other things, but circumstances brought me to this. I'm not saying this exactly. I'd have to find the part where he literally says this. This is after he begins drinking openly in the daytime, where you just right, see him right. drinking from the bottle. And then now Robert, you know, knows just how crazy Sullivan's wife is, and the dog is gone. The dog has been taken away. And he says something like, circumstances made me what I am. And then we have Robert who says, or thinks, and even though he was a drunk and dirty, and it was very late at night, I believed him and liked him anyway, because having him there was much better than being alone. On the one hand, you could just sort of say, think, oh, okay, this is just like him being with this person, just not being alone. But I think that there's something else there too that he actually reveals towards at the very end about potential and dreams and being alive. And he's able to take from Sullivan this kind of almost like a dehortation, like how not to live, you know, how to not only just be the kind of person who lets life overwhelm them, you know, but it takes actually being around him for that to become a lesson, you know. And then we learn this kind of lesson, you know, it's sort of ensconced in this set of sadness within the story itself.
Gets to like what the rareness of this story. Mm-hmm. How many stories, I don't know of a story like this where, you know, I mean, kind of unusual friendship stories, not that, you know, I mean, there are stories, of course, but this one, it's always struck me as being that he does something very simple, which is he just listens to Sullivan, you know, nobody else is listening to Sullivan. And Robert realizes that if he just listens, maybe he'll get a story. And of course, you know, the implication and Jim published this story at a fairly young age. This is his first book. He was in his 30s, I believe, when this book came out.
And it was the first story, I think, for the Atlantic. The Atlantic published it as an Atlantic first.
Right.
And if you look at the yellowed PDF, it granted him this fellowship, kind of. Like, they gave him, he won some award so that he could go on and publish a collection of stories. I mean, obviously it was in his first collection, but this allowed him to have that first collection.
Yeah, and I mean, you think about it, it's just remarkable that the kind of, like, I mean, I would think if I was to read the story cold and not having any idea about its history or who wrote it or anything, I would think that it was naturally going to be written by somebody 30, 40 years after this alleged mm-hmm. thing might have happened, mm-hmm. right? And in his case, I think it's much closer in time, which makes it even more remarkable. And one of the beautiful things, and I'm always so happy to get to it, and it's pretty early, and it's at the very end of part one, where he says this: he was Irish, of course, and he took pride in Irish accomplishments when he could have none of his own. He had known Frank O'Connor when that writer had been at Harvard. He told me on many occasions how O'Connor had stopped to talk to him every day on his way to the yard. And then he talks about his sitting with James Michael Curley, the corrupt mayor of Boston who went to jail. And he's sitting with Curley, and Curley, a guy comes up to him and says, "Hey, Jim, Saul Bernstein, the Jew, wants to see you." And Curley, in his deep, memorial voice, had said to James Sullivan, "Let us go forth and meet this Israelite prince." I mean, it's one of my favorite moments. And then he just brings it home, like almost the whole reason we are here. These were his memories, and I would obediently put aside my garbage cans and laugh with him over the 100 or so colorful, insignificant little details which made up a lifetime of living in the basement of Harvard. Mm-hmm. And although they were of little value to me then, I knew that they were the reflections of a lifetime and the happiest moments he would ever have, being sold to me cheap, as youthful time is cheap, for as little time and interest as I wanted to spend.
Yes. And then that last line for that section, it was a buyer's bargain. Oh, I just love it. I just
Yeah, yeah, I mean, pause there because it's such an amazing. It's almost like a kick in the gut, that last final plot.
Jim's stories do a lot of what, to me, Stuart Dybeck's stories also do, which is that they kind of are always telescoping time. You know, like you have this way in which you might look at this one moment of time and it might not seem totally significant. It's always also about time, you know, and the perception of time and how fast or slow it goes relative to your positionality in it. Like if you're young, you know, or if you're old, and these memories, and for him to actually talk about the memories that Sullivan has, you know, of being, you know, someone who is Irish, but not, you know, an accomplished person, you know, and having to sort of live off of these other, you know, names, you know, as they came up in the sort of satellite and orbit of Harvard, you know, it's just, it's amazing. And it's not flashy. The thing is that I feel like a lot of times, sometimes new writers will just want to have something that's absolutely flashy, but this is dealing with some of the, you know, the philosophical aspects of life, or, you know, time. Who are we? You know, what makes us have any sort of worth, and what is our worth? And those are just, that's what the story is dealing with. That's the clay of it.
I see that too. You know, this idea about Sullivan saying to him, I don't want to burden you unduly.
Yeah.
And then he starts talking for a long time. But I like this idea of how it takes a little bit of time for that part of the relationship to take hold. And that part comes right after he talks about almost every night the cats wet the second floor while Meg Sullivan watched the Johnny Carson show and the dog howled and clawed the door. I just feel like, speaking of compression, like that part of the story says so much about what Robert understands about Sullivan. And not just this, right, but so much more about Sullivan. Sullivan is the janitor. Sullivan has to live this way with his wife and this crazy dog and all of the drinking. A few paragraphs down, he says, I would carry down my own glass so that I would not have to drink out of the bottle. Looking at him on the sofa, I could not be mad, because now I had many records for my stereo. A story that was going well, a girl who believed in me and belonged to me and not to the race, a new set of dishes, and a tomorrow morning with younger people. And then, I don't want to burden you unduly, he would always preface. But there's something here, too, about how compassionate and patient he is toward Sullivan, knowing that this is his life. This drinking, he's older, he has a terrible situation at home with the wife and the dog, and the cats, etc. Later on, I feel like he's a little bit less patient, of course, but he's so good-natured about how well things are going for him as an assistant janitor and collecting these stories, because he seems to know, he seems to perceive that he'll have an out. It's not too late for him like it is for Sullivan.
And yet he hangs in there. He actually, at 2 a.m, he will go down. Even he'll bring his own glass, but he'll go down there. And I'm so tempted to ask Zizi, and even what you just said, Yvette, makes me think of the person who wrote it. And I don't want to conflate, right? But there is part of the reason we wanted to talk to you, Zizi, is because I do want to go there. But before we do, I mean, there's so many moments, but the one that I also come to, and I'm like, right, here it is. It's when Sullivan is trying to keep him there. Now it's 4 a.m, and we have all been here. We've probably been, I know I've been this person, where I'm trying to keep somebody with me, listening, and I'll do whatever it takes. I'll talk about whatever it takes just so they won't leave. It's a harrowing paragraph. It would be 3 a.m. before I knew it, and then 3:30, and still he would go on. He hated politicians in general and liked to recount at these times his private catalog of political observations. By the time he got around to civil rights, it'd be 4 a.m., and I could not feel sorry or responsible for him at that hour. I would begin to yawn, and at first he would just ignore it. Then I would start to edge towards the door, and he would see that he could hold me no longer, not even by declaring that he wanted to be an honorary Negro because he loved the race so much. I hope I haven't unburdened you unduly, he would say again. Of course not, I would say, because it was over. He's already up and he's halfway out the door. But it just it's this heartbreaking scene that only you could get if you had the patience enough to not leave. And I don't know in real life Jim did hang around this janitor, but I could see him doing it.
Absolutely. I, you know, that's part of the story where when you're, I mean, I will say the whole story, you know, where I can see so much of Jim here, you know, and I know that we shouldn't necessarily read stories autobiographically because they stand on their own as their own, you know, yeah, their own story. But Jim would absolutely do this. And that's kind of why I believe that at the heart of this story is okay, we have potential on the one hand, but we just have humanity. I mean, if you were to think, well, this could Rob just continue to do this, you know, if you know that he has to be awake, he has, you know, and that's it. Well, he has a whole other life ahead of him, and he does know this, and that's true. But there's also that sort of like you are your brother's keeper, you know, sort of right. mentality to right. this, where, you know, if there's someone who needs you, you do something for them, whatever that thing is that can bring them some brief respite, some solace, some way in which to feel not quite so alone in the world, you know? And I feel as though we have here the reason this person, you know, Rob, is able to go on, and eventually we know and be a writer of stories, is not because they just have the talent for picking out details or they have the knack for wordsmithery, but because they can recognize what's at the heart of every that person, what makes them tick, and what is the sort of inner sadness that they're nursing, that is making them do the kinds of things they do, what's making them be a prisoner, you know, to themselves. And I think that, you know, you have very much a kind of correlation with this character, you know, our narrator here, Rob, who, because he is so kind-hearted, and it goes beyond just, I'm going to pick out a story here, you know, it also goes to, you know, who he is. He's telling the story of himself when he's also telling the story of Sullivan, not because they're so alike, but in right. some ways because they are so different.
Yeah, because they are so different. I mean, I think that, you know, the story is not about how two people come together as one, right? They, mm-hmm. you know, it's about, it couldn't be going in different directions.
But that gets to Jean as well, the girlfriend, yeah. you know, yes. because we have like another, I guess, you know, in Hollywood, I hate when they say, oh, this is the B plot, you know, like, but this is the sort of running along concurrently with the story of Sullivan. Is the story of him and his relationship to Jean and how that sort of how that breaks apart. And I love how he can just do this. Once again, if I just was just talking about what McPherson's able to just do within, I think I have here 9 pages or 8 pages, that's so economical. I mean, we have that one paragraph where they're playing that game of who's going to be on what side or who's going to have who or whatever. At one point, they, you know, they get off at one stop, but you can tell it's over for them. And that's also just a corollary here with this idea of difference. And yet, you know, there's this connection and you very much yearn for that connection to hold, but it's not going to.
Juliet, I'd love to know what you think about this section too, but I feel like the Gene part, right, it is a B plot, I guess, right? And you could say, I mean, you know, it's not a perfect, absolutely perfect story, which is why I love it so much. Is, you know, Jean is, you know, has her moments on the page, but is sort of summed up as very brutally, very early on in the story, as a artistic rich girl who's sort of kind of exploring stuff. I mean, it's a pretty rough description. It's I mean, I wouldn't want to be the person this story is based on as the Jean character, right? But and yet I think about the two of them on the subway, you know, late in the story, being imaginative people. Jean and I played a number of original games, and then they're on the subway, and there wasn't enough room on either side for the two of us to sit, and we would not separate, and so we stood holding on to a steel post through all the stops, feeling all the eyes between the two sides of the car and the two sides of the world, we aged. And, you know, like you said, that's the point where they're literally trying to sort of outlast or outrun people's judgment about them as a mixed race couple. As a, she's basically, you know, she's also, I guess she's English or Irish or something. Anyway, whatever she is, they're not going to make it. And yeah. It's something heartbreaking about that, because in this story or in the worldview that McPherson kind of honored so much is that you think that would work. Right. Mm-hmm. But not every time.
Can you finish reading that paragraph, Peter?
Oh, yeah.
And getting off finally at the stop, which was no longer ours, we looked at each other again expectantly, and there was nothing left to say. And like Zizi, you said, like, that, how economical an ending of a love story is that?
And when I was reading over that again, I was just reminded of in Tolstoy's War and Peace, and they're just, I mean, for such a huge book, you wouldn't necessarily think, you know, he's economical, and there are many parts where he absolutely isn't with his sort of essays on his great man theory, etc. But there are essays where, not essays, sorry, there are parts where when Natasha falls in love, and it's like one paragraph, and that's it. I was just reminded of that with reading this. It's like, we have, you know, Gina's been on a shelf for a while for some of the story, and then bringing her back in, and then only for this to be like, oh, okay, then, you know, they're on the train, and they're off the train, and that's the subway, I should say, and it's over, you know? And he does that in one paragraph, you know? Yeah. I think it's kind of amazing that he's able to do that.
Even before that, where it says in part four, why don't you tell that old man your job doesn't include babysitting with him? Jean told me many times when she came over to visit during the day and found me sleeping. I would look at her and think to myself about social forces and the pressures massing and poised, waiting to attack us. It was still July then. It was hot, and I was working good. He's just an old man, I said. Who else would listen to him? You're too soft. As long as you do your work, you don't have to be bothered with him. And then after the nothing left to say, immediately after, talk about, right, the compression, I began to avoid the old man, would not answer the door when I knew it was he who was knocking. And then Miss O'Hara finally succeeded in badgering Murphy, the celibate Irishman, and a few other tenants into signing a complaint about the dog. And then things just start to unravel from that point. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he tells us these things. He tells us, and then we sort of see it, you know. Ultimately, we'll see it, and then he'll tell us. So there's, someone once said that you have to know when to march and when to camp, or when to camp and when to march, fictionally, like when to summarize and do that sort of interpretive narratorial gloss, and when to actually show in scene. And somehow in the story, he's able to get it, I think, absolutely right. Like when we need, you know, this just a little bit of exposition, we get it. And when we need to just see things for ourselves or hear things for ourselves, we absolutely get it. That was a great point. That, yeah, absolutely.
Like the battle for that, like how to know when to, you know, I'm always beating myself up, like get in scene, stop, you know, glossing. But like sometimes, and like you say, like here, like there is that time when, you know, camp out, you know. It seems like the story, the image that always, always bubbles up when I think of this story is Sullivan and his wife Meg walking through Harvard Square, and just being this sort of, you know, this couple that's barely moving. And Sullivan actually tells Rob this. He says, because this guy, some hippie called us Mr. and Mrs. Speedy Molasses. And I always think of the two of them sort of going through Harvard Square. And they're the only people in Harvard Square that the Japanese tourists don't take pictures of. And I feel like he allowed the story to kind of just be them. I mean, I like, the story's not about Rob's great triumph as a fiction writer, even though it may represent McPherson's, you know, but we don't know what happens to Rob. We know that he moves on. Of course he's going to move on, but there is this sort of sense of him honoring these two characters, you know, Sullivan especially, but also Meg. The thing with the dog and Meg, and we could get into the weeds about that, but it's just, he says, at one point he defends Meg to Sullivan. He says, well, anybody who loves dogs can't be that bad. You know,
anyone. I know. She's a South African woman who loves, you know, animals more than people. But he still is able to have that great sort of hold some sort of, I don't know, sympathy or just some endearment for her. And it's great. It's absolutely great. The other thing we were talking about this, you know, the Sullivans are the only ones that the Japanese tourists don't take pictures of. It just reminds you also of this other second cast of characters in this story. So we don't just have the, you know, the ones who are in the building, but we have the ones that are at Harvard Yard as well. And they're kind of, you know, faceless or rather nameless, but it's that, it's just maybe that first page where after talking about how it was a funny building, he talks a little bit about Harvard Yard and says, I expected to find it, meaning the building, occupied by a company of hippies, hopeful working girls, and assorted graduate students. Instead, there was a majority of old maids, dowagers, asexual middle-aged men, homosexual young men, a few married couples, and a teacher. No one was shacking up there and walking through the quiet halls in the early evening. I'd sometimes had the urge to knock on a door and expose myself just to hear someone breathe hard for once. But before that, I think I'm missing the part that I was trying to talk about, which was the one where he talks about the middle-aged men who are just looking at these women, these couples that are kissing, you know, necking was the word of the day. And then you have them and they are just, the word middle-aged, you know, kept creeping up time and time again. Like after that one paragraph I read, it was a Cambridge spring down by the Charles. Happy students were making love while sad-eyed middle-aged men watched them from the bridge. And then we have later on, you know, what the middle-aged men, you know, one of them, instead of just watching, he decides he's going to try to break up, you know, one of the kissing sessions. And we have the real, like, the end of the story with a kind of like this end of some of these happy times, you know, at Harvard Yard, where right. You have someone is murdered, you know, some bad things occur, and it sort of is all of a piece with Sullivan's, you know, gradual decrepence and descent into drink.
I love that part about the guys on the bridge looking down, and one of so many sentences that you can pull out. But we endured and aged, and August was almost over. I always think about that line too. It's like there's a sense of sort of like the time, the summer's over. We're going into fall. Things are kicking into a different gear, and Gene and I are probably going to break up, and I'm going to leave Sullivan, and things are going to change. But. Where we've come at this point is like, I don't know, he's willing to look back at it, you know? Mm-hmm.
But then in late September, those middle-aged men are down by the Charles, catching the last phases of summer sensuality before the grass grew cold and damp and before the young would be forced indoors to play. I wondered what those hungry spying men did in the winter or at night when it was too dark to see. Perhaps I thought they just stood there and listened. So even the... You know, even the topography has changed. Everything will be cold and damp soon. So, and then we get to October. Not to speed things up, but then we eventually get to October, too.
Absolutely.
Zizi, would you mind reading, like, the end of the story just to...
Sure, absolutely. During the first week of September, one of the middle-aged men down by the Charles got tired of looking and tried to take a necking girl away from her boyfriend. The police hauled him off to jail, and the girl pulled down her dress tearfully. A few days later, another man exposed himself near the same spot. And that same week, a dead body was found on the banks of the Charles. The miniskirted brigade had moved out of the yard, and it was quiet, green, and peaceful there. In our building, another Jewish couple moved into number 44. They did not eat gourmet stuff, and on occasion threw out pork and bean cans. But I had lost interest in perception. I now had many records for my stereo, loads of S.S. Pierce stuff, and a small bottle of Chivas Regal, which I never opened. I was working good again, and I did not miss other things as much, or at least I told myself that. The old man was coming up steadily now, at least 3 times a day, and I resigned myself to it. If I refused to let him in, he would always come back later with a missing bulb on the 5th floor. We had taken to buying cases of beer together. And when he had finished his half, which was frequently, he would come up to polish off mine. I began to enjoy talking politics, the AMA, Medicare, beatniks, and listening to him recite from books he had read. I discovered that he was very well read in history, philosophy, literature, and law. He was extraordinarily fond of saying, "I am really a cut above being a building superintendent. Circumstances made me what I am." And even though he was drunk and dirty, it was very late at night, and I believed him, and I liked him anyway, because having him there was much better than being alone. After he had gone, I could sleep, and I was not lonely in sleep. And it did not really matter how late I was at work the next morning, because when I thought about it all, I discovered that nothing really matters except not being old and being alive and having potential to dream about and not being alone.
James Allen McPherson is the author of Gold Coast. ZZ Packer is the author of Drinking Coffee Elsewhere. Her work is frequently published in such journals as The New Yorker and Granta. She's been awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship, the American Academy in Berlin Prize, and a Radcliffe Institute Fellowship. She's taught at many institutions, including Princeton, where she was a Hodder Fellow, the Michener Center at the University of Texas, Vassar College, and as a Jones Lecturer at Stanford. She received her education at Yale, Johns Hopkins, the University of Iowa, and Stanford as a Stegner Fellow. Stay tuned for more episodes of The Lonely Voice with ZZ Packer coming very soon. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.